The Rules Committee reported back to the convention on Monday, May 28th, the same day that Caleb Strong arrived in Philadelphia and Benjamin Franklin finally hobbled into the assembly room after being carried in a sedan chair from his home on Market Street by four burly convicts from the Walnut Street prison. The rules were short and to the point. First of all, a quorum of seven states was necessary to do business. All speakers were to address the president, Washington in other words, and no one was to pass between them or hold discourse with another or read a book, pamphlet, or paper, or manuscript. If they'd had smartphones in the 18th century, they would all have been collected at the door. All deliberations would take place behind closed doors to prevent leaks of their proceedings appearing in licentious publications. And motions to reconsider items would always be in order. Now, these might seem like mere procedural matters, but in fact, they turned out to have long innings. Closing the proceedings to the public may have given the appearance of doing things in a corner, but it allowed the members of the convention to speak their minds freely without fear that notes would be taken and that the notes would then fall into hostile political hands. And all of this could be done without a need for grandstanding by certain of the more voluble members of the delegations. And keeping all subjects open for reconsideration, well, that would make the convention debates a headache for anyone hoping to see a tidy flow of subjects moving from point A to point B to point C and D. It nevertheless allowed the convention to keep its mind open and malleable as the scaffolding of a new instrument of government emerged. It meant they were sometimes in the danger of always doing something and then going back to lengths to revisit it under the terms of reconsideration, but it kept things flexible, and that turned out to be very important. Some of the Rules Committee recommendations rolled over into the morning of Tuesday, May 29th, by which time everyone was finally ready for the main business to be opened. Edmund Randolph was on his feet at once to be recognized by Washington. With the acute politeness every 18th century gentleman was expected to demonstrate, Randolph made a preliminary show of what he called his regret, that it should fall to him rather than those who were of longer standing in life and political experience to open the great subject of their mission. However, he was happy to remind everyone, as the convention had originated from Virginia, the Virginia delegation had imposed this task on him. He was careful to cast no aspersions on the authors of the Articles of Confederation, especially since their original designer, John Dickinson, had just taken his seat in the convention that morning. No, Randolph insisted that he considered them as having done all that patriots could do in the then infancy of the science of constitutions, of confederacies. This might not have been quite the compliment Dickinson and his fellow Delawareans prized, but it allowed Randolph to tick off a list of defects in the Articles, which had emerged in the course of implementing the Articles. In 1781, Randolph said, the inefficiency of requisitions was unknown. In other words, trying to raise money by Congress passing the hat to the states, that had turned out to be a flat failure. But in 1781, when the Articles were originally written, well, no one really knew that that was going to turn out that way. Also in 1781, no commercial discord had arisen among any states. So, when the Articles were written, no one could have anticipated the difficulties, commercially speaking, that existed between the states, as we have seen in the later 1780s. There was also, in 1781, no rebellion as had appeared in Massachusetts, the shadow of Daniel Shays again. Foreign debts in 1781 had not become urgent. Well, maybe not urgent for Americans. That might not have been the same opinion shared by lenders in France and in Amsterdam. But nevertheless, Americans did not feel them urgent. In 1781, the havoc of paper money had not been foreseen. Treaties had not been violated. And on Randolph went, piling up the stack of deficiencies that no one had been able to see in 1781, but could now see very clearly in 1787, to the point where the sheer weight of them had to extinguish any idea that the convention could simply confine itself to a few amendments and consider its job done. That opened a path to 15 resolutions which Randolph laid before the convention as Virginia's and Madison's plan for a new national government. And those resolutions began like this: that Congress be restructured to consist of two branches, that representation in the national legislature ought to be proportioned to the number of free inhabitants in each state, that the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states, and the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the individual legislatures of the states. Then the real sting: that the new Congress have clear and unquestioned authority over the states, that this national legislature be empowered to legislate in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent, or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation, to negative all laws passed by the several states, contravening, in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of Union, and to call forth the force of the Union against any member of the Union failing to fulfill its duty under the articles thereof. Almost as radical was Randolph's resolution that a national executive be instituted with a general authority to execute the national laws. This executive would represent a second independent department of the government. It would, in other words, no longer be like Thomas Mifflin, merely the presiding officer of the Congress. And there was also to be a third department, a national judiciary, to consist of one or more supreme tribunals and of inferior tribunals to be chosen by the national legislature to hear cases in which foreigners or citizens of other states applying to such jurisdictions may be interested, or which respect the collection of the national revenue. No more Rhode Island law by whim, no more state courts acting as though they had power over everyone else's affairs. And just to make it clear that political power was now shifting decisively from the state to the national level, Randolph added a penultimate resolution: that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers within the several states ought to be bound by oath to support the Articles of Union. Randolph's speech and the presentation of his resolutions took up most of Tuesday's session. And while the hands in these resolutions may have been Randolph's, the voice was clearly that of James Madison. Which makes all the more surprising the proposal laid before the House by the next and last speaker of the day. The South Carolina delegation was composed of two men with the name Pinckney, the first being the highly influential Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, who had led South Carolina into the Revolution, fought under Washington's command, and had even endured a spell as a prisoner of war after the surrender of Charleston to the British in 1780. His younger cousin, Charles Pinckney, had also fought in the Revolution and endured capture at the surrender of Charleston, but he was discounted by many as an empty-headed fop, as Blackguard Charlie, whose hunger for public acclaim induced him to be seen in the streets of Charleston in a big carriage, as it was described, to receive the grateful tribute of bows from the sans-culottes and other low fellows. So it was entirely outside of Madison's careful planning to have Blackguard Charlie Pinckney announce that he had his own draft of a federal government, which he had prepared to be agreed upon between the free and independent states of America. And what was even more galling, what was that Pinckney's plan was not a bad one. In fact, it was not dissimilar to what Madison and the Virginia delegation had worked upon so carefully and which Edmund Randolph had just introduced. Madison, in what many have regarded as a fit of pique, declined to include anything of Pinckney's proposal in his posthumous minutes of the convention beyond the bare mention of its introduction on May 29th. Pinckney later supplied what he claimed was a copy of his proposal to John Quincy Adams in 1822. Otherwise, we would not have known exactly what it was Pinckney had in mind. Nevertheless, we do have those notes that he later submitted. And from those notes, we find out the following. There should be, Pinckney declared, a bicameral National Congress. He labeled one branch the Senate, borrowing the name from the ancient Roman Council of Elders, and the other the House of Delegates. The House of Delegates was to be elected by the citizens of the United States as a whole, with one member for every 1,000 inhabitants, while the Senate was to be elected from 4 districts, either by the House of Delegates or directly by the people at large. Together, the House of Delegates and the Senate shall by joint ballot annually choose a president, in whom the executive authority of the United States shall be vested. Every state would retain its rights. But like Randolph's plan, state laws and legislation would be subject to review by the Congress, and no bill of the legislature of any state shall become a law till it shall have been laid before the Senate and House of Delegates in Congress assembled and received their approbation. This was actually a slightly more radical plan than Randolph's. And it is peculiar that Madison's otherwise exquisitely detailed notes make no mention at all of any of the Pinckney plan's provisions. What is certain is that Madison loathed him. He denounced Pinckney in terms so scathing that Washington dryly remarked to Madison that Mr. C.P. is unwilling, I perceive by the enclosures contained in your favor of the 13th, to lose any fame that can be acquired by the publication of his sentiments. So whether Pinckney really drafted a viable forerunner of the Constitution on his own, or, as Madison believed, or wanted everyone else to believe, Pinckney confected such a plan long after the fact in order to boost his own self-importance, that is one of the many mysteries that will always surround the Constitutional Convention. Nor in the eyes of delegates like George Read did it much matter whether Randolph or Pinckney were the ones chiefly responsible for handing a newly redesigned National Congress more power. Read felt it necessary to remind the convention that the deputies from Delaware were restrained by their commission from assenting to any change of the rule of suffrage. And in case such a change should be fixed on, it might become their duty to retire from the convention. But the most vocal opponent of any such plan was a member of the New Jersey delegation, William Patterson. The observant William Pierce noticed Patterson in his character sketches of the delegates and characterized him as being something of a sleeper, a man so unobtrusive that you scarcely noticed him until he had trussed you up in one of his nets. He was one of those men whose powers break in upon you and create wonder and astonishment. At 5 feet 2 inches, with a slight build and an aquiline nose that tapered to a receding forehead, Patterson cut no swashbuckling figure among the delegates. Irish by birth, he was brought as a 2-year-old to New Jersey by his immigrant parents and graduated from Princeton in the class of 1763, a decade ahead of Madison, where he studied with the great Samuel Davies, that great awakener who had so moved Patrick Henry, and who was, by that point, president of Princeton. Patterson became a lawyer. In fact, he became the first Attorney General of Revolutionary New Jersey and represented Somerset County in the New Jersey legislature. But like Patrick Henry, Patterson was utterly unreconciled to the kind of rewriting of the Articles that Edmund Randolph had in view. For all the years of the Continental Congress and the Confederation Congress, small states like New Jersey had enjoyed the same voting Congress that the large states like Virginia had, which is to say, one apiece. In the minds of Randolph and Madison, this was absurd. A state with only 1/10 the population of Virginia was accorded equal say in national policy, and in the case of Rhode Island, could obstruct, defy, and even veto legislation, as though it had the same heft as Virginia. That kept Virginia always dancing to the tune a handful of rogue islanders would demand. But to Patterson, this was the only safeguard that small states like his own had against being ground up as bait by the Virginians and the Pennsylvanians. This was not because Patterson had any personal sympathy with the fast and loose money policies of state governments. In a free government, Patterson wrote, men expect to live under equal and certain laws which operate alike on every member of the community. He wrote, where the guards of property are liable to be removed at the whim or pleasure of the supreme power in a state, a person has not anything that he can call his own or is sure of for a moment. But as Patterson listened to Randolph's presentation on May 29th, he began scribbling extensive notes, punctuated by expressions of dismay. Even as Patterson scribbled, Randolph was planning to keep the initiative firmly in the hands of the Virginians by moving that the convention resolve itself into a committee of the whole to discuss his plan. A committee of the whole is a charming parliamentary device which allows a deliberative or legislative body to convert itself into a committee. As a committee, the usual procedural rules then can be relaxed. Proposals can be made or withdrawn. Ideas can be batted around informally. Straw votes can be taken. And all without any sense that final decisions are being irretrievably made, because no such final decision could be reached until the committee once more metamorphosed itself into its convention form. And for the next 9 days, from May 30th through June 8th, the initiative stayed firmly in the hands of the Virginians, and the ebb and flow of discussion centered so entirely upon the Randolph proposals that any member might have wondered whether they were supposed to be the whole purpose of the convention. And in any case, if anyone had any doubt what the ultimate result of the Randolph plan might be, Gouverneur Morris took the opportunity to make those results very clear on May 30th. Here's what Gouverneur Morris said. That a union of the states, merely federal, will not accomplish the objects proposed by the Articles of Confederation, namely, common defense, security of liberty, general welfare. Second, that no treaty or treaties among the whole or part of the states as individual sovereignties would be sufficient. And therefore, three, that a national government ought to be established consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. So there it was, plain to see. We must junk the Articles of Confederation completely and invent a completely new document. There was a good deal of coughing and harumphing, but the momentum was irresistible. A vote on Morris's three guidelines passed with the support of six of the eight state delegations and one tie in the New York delegation, where Alexander Hamilton and the finicky Robert Yates disagreed, and only one negative from Connecticut. After that, and for the next several days, the business of the Committee of the Whole was taken up no longer with questions of whether to adopt the Randolph Plan, but simply how to adopt it. One by one, Randolph's proposals were relentlessly pushed through the Committee of the Whole's vote. The equality of suffrage for each state, mandated by the Articles, would yield to representation based on size of population. That the national legislature would have two branches, the first elected generally by the people. That the first branch would be the place where all legislation would originate. That the national legislature would have authority to negative all state laws contravening, in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of Union. Even Madison chimed in on June 8th to say that he could not but regard an indefinite power to negative legislative acts of the states as absolutely necessary to a perfect system. That a national executive would consist of a single person and be elected by the national legislature. By Wednesday, June 6th, even the truculent and suspicious George Reed of Delaware had been persuaded that the Confederation was founded on temporary principles and cannot last. It cannot be amended. Perhaps the whole business could be over before a long, sweltering Philadelphia summer set in. But these successes could not quite erase muttered suspicions and dissents over several annoying details. Edmund Randolph, for instance, was himself taken aback that his proposal for a national executive was now being converted towards a single-person office. This, he said, was the fetus of monarchy. And that muttering finally found a voice on Saturday, June 9th, when William Patterson was at last ready to speak. "Frankly," he said, without any preliminaries, "the whole proposal for a new national legislature, based on proportional representation, rather than giving each state the same vote, struck at the very existence of the lesser states. That was not what he understood the purpose of the convention to be. The convention was formed," said Patterson, "to amend the Articles of Confederation, and that was it. Not to rewrite the entire basis of a government. The Articles of the Confederation were therefore the proper basis of all the proceedings of the convention," he said. "And we ought to keep within its limits, or we should be charged by our constituents with usurpation. Even if every wise head in the assembly room agreed with Edmund Randolph's plan, that was not what the American people had called them to Philadelphia to do. The idea of a national government, as contradistinguished from a federal one, never entered into the mind of any of them," said Patterson. "And to the public mind, we must accommodate ourselves." Not only was the convention overstepping its remit from the people. It was launching into seas of theory that even delegates in the assembly room choked on, even if quietly. A confederacy, said Patterson, supposes sovereignty in the members composing it, and sovereignty supposes equality. But abolish equality of representation. Make the National Congress a place where the people in general are represented, not the states as the equal partners, and the identities of the states might as well be swallowed up. Give the large states an influence in proportion to their magnitude, and what will be the consequence, asked Patterson. Their ambition will be proportionately increased, and the small states will have everything to fear. The idea that Virginia or Pennsylvania should have more representation in Congress simply because they had greater populations was, for Patterson, like saying that a rich individual citizen should have more votes than an indigent one. Eventually, Patterson warned, if we are to be considered as a nation instead of a confederation, all state distinctions must be abolished. The whole must be thrown into hotchpot. What, he asked, was so unspeakably wrong with the current system of equal representation for each state in Congress? It has been said, Patterson continued, that if a national government is to be formed, the representatives ought to be drawn from the people. Well, was that goal less well served when Congress is supplied by delegates chosen by the states? Aren't the state legislatures that choose these delegates filled by the people who choose the state legislatures? Patterson had no idea what was unsettling the Virginians so much, but for his part, he said, he was strongly attached to the plan of the existing Confederacy, in which the people choose their legislative representatives and the legislatures their federal representatives. And not only Patterson, but all of New Jersey. With a flourish of defiance, Patterson announced that New Jersey will never confederate on the plan before the committee. She would be swallowed up. He had rather submit to a monarch, to a despot, than to such a fate. He would not only oppose the plan here, but on his return home, do everything in his power to defeat it there. It had seemed, until that moment, that the Randolph plan was sailing to adoption, and the committee of the whole would embrace it and recommend it to the convention. But William Patterson's speech completely altered the atmosphere in the assembly room. It has given me great pleasure, wrote Benjamin Franklin in a document James Wilson had to read aloud for him when the delegates assembled on Monday, June 11th, that till this point our debates were carried on with great coolness and temper. Franklin now pleaded that we are sent here to consult, not to contend with each other. And declarations of a fixed opinion and a determined resolution never to change it neither enlighten nor convince us. But the waters that Patterson had roiled were too disturbed to be pacified by the oil being poured on them by old Benjamin Franklin. Just as the momentum Randolph and Madison had built behind the Randolph plan was too great to be stopped by Patterson's speech alone. Starting on June 11th, the Committee of the Whole, one by one, began voting on the Randolph resolutions, with the New Jersey and Delaware delegations almost always voting no, and enough of the others voting yes to carry them all through, now in the form of 19 resolutions to be presented to the convention. William Patterson had foreseen this, and he was prepared on June 15th, when the convention once more reformed itself into a convention, to challenge the Randolph plan head on with an alternative plan of his own.